Roberts, a very good scorer for BYU, averaging 19 points a game.
Here's Roberts working on Tripucka, and Andre has scored. The rebound by Roberts. A tremendous effort by Roberts. To the hoop is Roberts.
Roberts posts up on Aguirre. His jump shot. Tie game. Roberts drives the baseline. Got it. Roberts, foul line jump. Yes. Roberts, good job to get it back. Shoots on the run. Good. Roberts free again. Good again. Sally tries to shut him down. He backs in. Fakes. Fires. Got it.
I tell you, Sally played great defense that time. That was just a very tough shot by Fred Roberts.
Roberts goes to the hole. Draws the foul. Boy, there's a big miss. Roberts. What a night he's had. 24 for Fred Roberts. Playing the game of his life when his team needs him the most. Roberts again. Lays it up and in. 26 for Roberts. Roberts has been brilliant. Roberts turns. Good again. He's hit 8 straight points. He has 28 in the game. He has been sensational. Roberts for 2, and he got him. He's got 30. Here's the red hot Fred Roberts.
Shouts to all my hoop heads out there. Another episode of Not In My House podcast. Eric's taking the day off today. He's out of the office, so our guest is stuck here with me. And what a guest it is. He's a BYU legend. Two-time first team All-WAC. The 27th pick of the 1982 NBA draft. He went on to have a successful 13-year career in the NBA and overseas. Spanish Cup winner, Mr. Fred Roberts. Fred, what's going on, man? How you doing today? Thanks for being on the show.
I'm well. Thank you, Zach.
Very excited to have you. As we were discussing before I hit the record button, you know, we had Devin Durant and Greg Kite on earlier, and they had a lot of great things to say about you. And, you know, I lived in Orem, Utah for a little bit, just down the street from BYU. I loved my time in Utah, and I'm just curious what your childhood is like growing up in Utah before the basketball got started.
Well, I grew up in Riverton, Utah, which was just a small town when I was growing up. I call it the sweet spot of growing up. It was just in the 60s and 70s in a small town. It was awesome. We'd ride our bikes down the middle of the road, Redwood Road, which is a crazy busy road now, but that's where we'd put our gloves on our handlebars, our baseball gloves on the handlebars, and ride down to the park where we had our baseball practice. And it was just great. We didn't know much about the professional sport world, didn't know hardly anything at all, really. But we knew somewhat. We started to learn about the high school and then college. I remember Kresmer Chosik at BYU, and that was kind of – he was one of the guys that I looked at, and I thought, yeah, if I played, I'd like to play like him. Athletic, running a lot. And not be stuck in the inside, but running around the perimeter and having fun. He just looked like he had so much fun playing basketball.
Yeah, absolutely. And was basketball really your first sport? I mean, did you experiment with other sports at all? Or, you know, if so, tell our listeners what other sports you played.
I would say it was my last sport. We did football, basketball, baseball. And baseball, we had a pretty good – WBBA, our town supported the Little League Baseball pretty well. We had 4 really strong, good teams, and that was my first love. I was a pitcher, I was a hitter, and from early age, I'll never forget. I look back and I see the kids now, but I was 8 years old, and I was a catcher for this kid named, he was a 12-year-old, Leland Mascaro. And I was the catcher, and this guy just was throwing hard, and I was so scared. And I think that this is one of those instances where fear is good. I was so afraid to let the ball go by me that I just did anything to stop it. I'd throw my body in front of it, catch it, whatever I had to do. And I don't think they let 8-year-olds play with 12-year-olds anymore. But I did, and then I loved them football. I loved football, did punt, pass, and kick. I actually won a trip to a professional football game in Denver, Colorado. to compete at halftime with punt, pass, and kick. So I loved that. And then it just kind of, as I got older and I got taller, they started to have more organization with the basketball in junior high. Up till then, there was no basketball organization, no little league teams, anything like that. There was just baseball, and then I had the punt, pass, and kick. But that's when I started playing basketball. It was indoors. It was easy to play in Utah through the winter because of the weather. And I just kind of grew into it. I became pretty good at it, became tall, and I continued to play baseball throughout high school, but focused on basketball.
Yeah, and I was going to say, it's not easy to be a pitcher and a hitter. I can't imagine, you know, being 6'10 on the mound in high school. I mean, that must have been pretty intimidating. So when'd you hit that big growth spurt?
Well, I was my senior year, I was about 6'8", 6'9", probably closer to 6'9 than I was to 6'8". And I talked to a few people who I didn't know then, but who I later in their life will run into them and says, oh, yeah, I remember I had to bat against you. And I was kind of I was a pretty decent pitcher. I could throw strikes, threw hard, and I wasn't afraid to. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I wasn't afraid to throw at people. You know, if I felt a guy was too comfortable, I would throw at them, and even in warmups, you know, I'd throw and I'd hit the back screen because I knew that they weren't comfortable or good going to bat against this giant out on the mound. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want them to be comfortable. But that's what I did. And I really enjoyed it. I loved pitching. It was my first sport. But as I became more and more of a basketball player, I kind of forgot how to pitch a little bit.
Yeah. And you and I were kind of the same in the sense that we weren't afraid to throw at people. I mean, I played baseball growing up, and I always tried to test them a little bit with the chin music and test them a little bit. So I totally understand you on that. And, you know, you mentioned how you played a lot indoors. It's always interesting when we speak to our guests about the playground or the blacktop hoop scene. But did you play a lot of blacktop as a kid? And if so, was that important for your development as a person and a player, or were you strictly indoors?
Well, when we played, there just weren't any opportunities to play indoors. There, you know, they'd lock all the churches. We try to break into churches. We were always getting in trouble when we did. And so we played out on the patio, you know, the concrete slabs where most of our games were. But I had five brothers, and I had one brother who was very close in age with me, and we were always about the same height until he stopped at 6'4", and I kept going. But we were always, until then, we were about the same height. And we would go out and we'd play one-on-one forever on the concrete. We would play games, almost daily, games to 100. And the games were always, they'd go into overtime. And so we'd have to win by two baskets. And so we'd win games at 114 to 110.
Wow.
Or 112 to 108. And then I had an oldest brother who I could never beat because he was just meaner than anybody. And there was no way. If it got close to where I could compete against him, he would just beat me up. So I didn't like him very much.
Yeah.
But the brother was just older than me. We spent a lot of time one-on-one there together.
Yeah, I know how those sibling matches can get. They can get pretty heated. I had two older sisters that were over 6 feet tall, and, you know, they loved beating up on the younger brother. And they were good players, man. They were tough. They toughened me up for sure. But, you know.
Well, Reggie Miller, that's how he learned, he said. He was beaten up by his sisters.
Exactly. And if you can give our listeners an idea of what the high school hoop scene was like for you in Utah. Like, did you go up against any familiar names that our listeners might know, or did you have a rival maybe? What can you tell us about that experience?
Well, the first thing I'd actually like to mention, I loved my oldest brother. They had a really good team, and they played at Bingham High School. And there was a guy We'd go watch. We'd go watch all the high school games, and it was just there's our basketball, which eventually became the basketball team. But at the time, there was no Little League basketball, so we weren't. But we'd watch these guys, and there was a guy named Bruce Hardy, who was the high school athlete of the year nationwide. And they say he was the first high school athlete to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And we'd go watch him every week. And this guy was just a beast. You know, he played football, basketball, baseball, and that's kind of the way it was at Bingham. You played, if you were on the football team, you were probably on the basketball team. If you're on the basketball team, you're probably on the baseball team. And we'd get to go watch this guy, and it was just so much fun to see how good he was and what and the possibility of being that good. He's really probably the first guy to open my eyes to seeing how good you could be. And then my oldest brother who played with him, I never did play with him. I played with Bruce's younger brother, who was just a great athlete. And so I have to look at those years of watching those guys play to kind of develop my competitive spirit, my love for competition, love for basketball. In high school, the names that you would know would be Danny Vrains, who I never played against him, but he was just a year ahead of me. And so I'd kind of watch him, and I'd get to see some of how athletic he was and great he was. Devin Durant, of course, again, he was my same year as me. Who else was back then? I don't know, but those are a couple of guys I played against. And Devin was, we played against each other in tournaments, all-star tournaments. And really the first time we played against each other, and I knew who he was. I knew he was the MVP of the 4A or whatever it was. The first time we played each other, he gave me an elbow to the face and split my eye open. Oh, no. So I ended up going to get stitches. He was dirty. Oh, that guy was a dirty player. Of course, you'd expect that from him, right?
Right. Yeah, we had him on. He was a lot of trouble for sure. No, he was a great guest. We really enjoyed him. But you mentioned how those experiences kind of made you understand what it took to get to the next level. And I'm just curious if you hit a moment when you knew that you were ready for the next level, because there's really no social media or AAU back then. So how did you get exposure? Like, did you go to the big camps or the Nike camps to kind of test how you were against the elite competition, or how did you really get an idea of where you're at?
You know, you're exactly right. There really wasn't any of these big camps or tournaments. When these kids in high school now, they'll go play in tournaments anywhere in the country. I remember our senior year, Devin, he was put on the McDonald's All-American team. So he got to go play back east somewhere. And that was a sore spot for me that I didn't get to do that. But I think my ninth and 10th grade year, I played as a sophomore. We didn't have ninth grade high school, but as a sophomore, I started on our high school team and was the second leading scorer on that team next to that Axel Hardy. But I recognized then, there were some pretty good senior centers my sophomore year. There were five, six guys who were 6'8" or more, which was very uncommon. But that year they were good, and I played against them, and I competed just fine with them, and I kind of got the feel for it. But probably the time when I really thought, okay, I can do this, they had an all-star camp in San Diego or Point Loma, California, just north of San Diego. They had all the supposedly best basketball players in the region west of the Rocky Mountains go to this camp, and I won the one-on-one tournament there, and our team did really well. When I came back, I remember my dad was not much, wasn't much of a sportsman. So he had me out working in the yard. I don't know, we were digging ditches or something. But he looked at me and he said, "So are you pretty good?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I am." He said, "Do you think you could get a scholarship?" And I said, "I think I can." "Huh, okay, all right." And that's when he and I both at the same time thought, "Yeah, maybe I can do this."
I love hearing stories like that, because you really don't hear stories like that anymore, because kids these days really have a pretty clear idea of where they're going to go now. But what was the recruiting process like for you? You had an older brother that went to BYU, and was that an easy pick for you to go to BYU, or was there a close number two, or what was that process like?
I think that I always wanted to play on a team with my older brother, but he was – So I was in ninth grade when he was a senior, so I couldn't play with him then. And he was at BYU, and I thought, so I wanted to play with him on the same team. And I think I didn't really explore many other teams. Utah a little bit, but I didn't go outside of that. And I think people knew that. At that time, players from Utah always seemed to stay in Utah. And so there weren't any schools outside of Utah who would come in and recruit much. I got some attention from Notre Dame, which was kind of fun. And that would have been a fun place to go. And Notre Dame, I got a couple letters from Duke, but the only ones that really paid any attention to me, Notre Dame, BYU, and Utah.
Yeah. And I think you made the right decision, because you ended up beating Notre Dame in a NCAA tournament, which we'll get to in a little bit. But, you know, you got to grow with Devin Durant and Greg Kite, both Not My House alumni. And, you know, they spoke very highly of you. And, of course, you know, there's all the Danny Ainge stories that we got to hear. And, I mean, you guys all really got to grow together for a few years. So what was an everyday practice like at BYU? Like, what are some of your favorite memories playing with those guys?
Well, I think maybe Greg mentioned this, Greg, but when he was a freshman, we had another center, Alan Taylor, and both of those guys were the same kind of players, really, just big, strong brutes. And it seemed like every day of practice, one of them was leaving the court to go get stitches, just bloody face, and just, you know, because they just beat each other to death. And I did everything I could to avoid that mess.
Yeah. You're just going to stay away from Devin, right?
And then Devin, yeah, I kept him on the other side of the court between Devin and I. And then Danny, it was a fun team, because there were a lot of options and we were athletic enough that we could move the ball. Danny could always create space, could always create opportunities for for his teammates. Devin, you know, he's good as offensive players I've known, really. He can just put the ball in the basket. And so in practice, we got going, especially that junior year, we kind of just started feeling like we can pretty much do what we want. We've got enough good players. If the team's defend us this way, we know that we're going to do this offensively and they're not going to be able to stop us. And then teams couldn't match up. And when they try to match up, we would recognize who had the weakest defender on them. And that's who we would go to.
Yeah.
And of course, Danny always thought that was him.
It's not surprising. Not surprising. No, I mean, it was a magical run. I mean, we've got to hear about it a little bit, but it's always interesting hearing it from somebody different, because when I just got a name drop a couple of these guys from these teams, like, I mean, Princeton was tough, but then you got UCLA with Darren Day, Mark Eaton, Mike Sanders, and Notre Dame with John Paxson, Joe Klein, Woolrich, Kelly Trapuka, but then you get Virginia with Sampson and Jeff Lamp. Like, what was that tournament like, just from like trying to prepare for these teams in such little time? Like, what do you remember from that run?
Well, the first thing I remember is that our first game, we went flew all the way back to Rhode Island, I think it was, right? We went all the way back to Rhode Island, and Danny, his back went into spasm. And so we were concerned with that. We didn't know if he'd even be able to play that first game. And maybe that somehow took some of our – distracted us enough from what was going on. We were just trying to say, okay, we got to get Danny ready. And if he isn't ready, what are we going to do? And in the end, he was able to play, which was great. And there was a kid I played against. I ran into him. I don't know if you remember. So Coach Robinson, I think he was at Oregon for a while, and then he went – I don't know where he is now. But I ran into him back in Milwaukee, and he says, yeah, I was – do you remember that? Remember we played against you? And I kind of do remember seeing his name. It's like a picture I can take. I can see a name on a blackboard or whiteboard, whatever, when we're doing the scouting report. And I remember seeing his name, and he was pretty athletic. Well, it turns out this kid is Michelle Obama's brother, or she's his sister.
Yeah.
And he reminded me of that. And I said, oh, okay, cool, right. So we end up, Danny feels better. He plays that game. And then UCLA, I just remember from the tip that we just had those guys. We had that number, and it's so much fun to watch. Well, watching the game after and listening to Al McGuire and whoever the other guy was, how they were saying, oh, these BYU kids, they're just not going to be able to keep up with UCLA. They're just not going to be able to run with them. And we ran those guys ragged. But even into the third quarter, into the second half, well, UCLA, they're going to get their legs under them. It's just a matter of time. The BYU is not going to be able to keep up with them. But at the end, I guess they took care of them. We did. We kind of ran those guys. We were running fast breaks on them. Danny was out there at half court, and we'd get that rebound, toss it out to him, and he was just on fire. That game, I think he knew that it was a coming out game for him, and he just pulled up from back then when there wasn't a three-pointer. But we'd outlet the ball to him at half court. He'd dribble down. If there was somebody back, he'd pull up.
Yeah.
15, 20, 25 feet, and he'd hit it. And he'd hit the next one. He got so – he was so hot, or so good that they – that was our fast break, really. They just couldn't keep up with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. My dad is a huge Danny Ainge fan, loves the Celtics, so I definitely got to hear a lot of Danny Ainge stories back in the day, so it's really cool that you were able to share that. And, I mean, what a team that was, too. I mean, you guys were sneakily very fast, I mean, because you guys were very long, and I bet a lot of opponents went into games thinking that you guys are going to be slow, but you guys could move for your size. And after that run, I mean, you obviously played another year, but what was the NBA draft process like for you? I mean, because the draft was a lot different back then. Did you have a lot of workouts, any draft night surprises? I mean, it must have been a special and stressful time at the same time. So what can you share about that?
Well, for me, it was very disappointing. My senior year was not good at all. It was just not a good experience. I didn't play well. The team didn't play well. And after my junior year, having a really good year, having a team that we were so athletic and we would run with everything. That's part of the reason why I went to BYU is because, I knew Frank Arnold came from UCLA and I knew that they ran, and I had a sense that if I was going to be able to move on to the next level, I'd have to be able to run. I wasn't going to be big and bulky enough, strong enough to just pound it inside. I'd have to be a runner. I thought that was one way I could get to the next level. And so my senior year, I had a really good junior year, and I look back, and not many guys were coming out then. I think I would have been better off coming out, not saying that I would have been a top pick, but I was a better player then. I was a better player mentally, physically, my junior year.
Probably just confidence-wise then, right?
Confidence-wise, yeah. Exactly. I think I would have just come out and I'd have been a better player. That senior year was such a disappointment, heavy, dark time. And then our draft, there, you know, we didn't have any workouts. We did do a couple of where they put teams together in different places. We went to New Orleans. We played a little tournament there. We went to, I think there was a tournament in Hawaii. And I played in those tournaments, and I think I was, you know, I didn't show great, but I showed that I could move, and I showed I was tall, and I was fairly athletic. And but my that year, there were 13 underclassmen come out.
Yeah.
And every one of those underclassmen were drafted in the first round. And that pushed me back to the 27th player pick. I think otherwise, even with a bad year, I would have been, well, with 13 guys, I would have moved up, because the 27th player pick then was the second player in the second round.
Yeah.
And so I would have moved up into the first round for sure. Well, I don't know for sure, but I feel like I would have, even with a bad year. And that would have made a big difference. But I just kind of, I was really unsure of myself and my abilities. And Milwaukee drafted me, which actually would have been a great draft. But Don Nelson, I met with him, and he looked at me and he says, I don't know why. He was the coach of Milwaukee, and he said, I don't know why I drafted you. I don't want you.
Oh, wow.
General manager kind of pushed you, but I don't want you. And oh, boy.
That's quite the welcoming right there.
Yes, thanks. Just what you'd expect from Don Nelson, right?
Yeah,
he's such a nice guy. But so what happened, and then I had picked an agent who didn't want to work for me, didn't want to, he just, and I didn't know this till like at the end of my career, but these agents, they can make easy money when they send a guy over to Europe. They make more money, the agents do make more money sending guys over there than they did keeping them here. Right. Not now, because the money's so crazy. So I just thought, after Don Nelson told me that, and then my agent said, hey, we got you a job over in Italy. And all right, I'll take the job in Italy, I guess, because I just wasn't comfortable that things would work out in Milwaukee, but they would have.
Yeah.
That would have been a really good place for me.
Yeah.
So I go over there, and the one positive thing that happened over in Italy is we had a coach who didn't know much, and so he just ran us. And I think that's what coaches do when they don't know very much. They just run.
Yeah. And they hope to God you'll get, you know, steals or, you know, that kind of thing. I totally get that. Yeah,
something. And so practices, that's all we did. We ran and ran. He put us on a track, actually. We were on the track. We'd have to run laps on the track. But coming back, I think that helped me. And we played one preseason. Well, we played a couple of preseason games, but we played a preseason game against a group of NBA players who were kind of touring, doing a barnstorming through Europe. And for some lucky, it is an absolute blessing. I don't know how it happened, but our team, we were terrible, but for some reason. We were on their schedule to play us. They had Kevin McHale. They had Michael A. Richardson. They had James Donaldson, Kelly Tripucka, a bunch of these guys who were in the NBA and established good players.
Yeah.
Well, I had probably the best game of my life. I scored 43 points against these guys. Just
oh, wow.
It was a game where we'd have a timeout. And the guys had come around. They said, what are we going to do now? I said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. Get me the ball. And that was just – but anyway, Stan Albeck was the coach of that team. And I think he must have, you know, of course, I must have taken note and said, oh, okay, this kid can kind of play a little bit. And so that next year, Milwaukee traded me to New Jersey. And then at the end of the season, Stan Albeck, New Jersey wanted some, for some reason, wanted Stan Albeck to go coach New Jersey. But San Antonio wanted some compensation.
Yeah.
So they threw me in the deal where they sent me to San Antonio for partial compensation for Stan Albuck, the coach, which was a good move for me too. I don't think New Jersey would have worked out very well for me, but San Antonio was a good place. It was comfortable. I had an opportunity to play some there and kind of get established a little bit.
Yeah. What was I love asking this question because we always get some interesting stories out of it, but when you get to the Spurs and when you get to the NBA, what was your welcome to the league moment? And what I mean by that was, who's the first guy to really just kick your butt to where you're thinking like, wow, the NBA is a totally different level. Like, what was that moment? You must have had that moment, right?
Oh, boy. Yeah, well, in practice, this Michael I'm not going to think of his name right now. I matched up with him in practice. We were both the small forwards or whatever. Can't believe I can't remember his name. But anyway, that guy could just flat out shoot and he could score. I'd never heard of him before. Because again, back then, the only people on on TV was Boston and LA. Right. So I didn't know this kid at all. He was played at Auburn, but he was on the Spurs, and man, he could shoot, just flat out shoot. And he kind of just
Auburn, was it Mike Mitchell?
Mitchell, that's the guy.
Okay.
Mike Mitchell, and so I figured out pretty quickly. Oh boy, that guy! I got to figure out how to do that. But then playing against somebody, this guy named Purvis Short. I swear, if he saw me come in the gym, I think he says he could have had two broken legs and a broken finger. I'm playing tonight. I'm playing. Roberts is out there. I'm playing.
Yeah.
And he just tore me up. I could not get to his shot, and he'd make everything. I think he was the first guy to score. I'm sure he had 40 plus on me.
Oh, wow.
And so that wasn't very much fun, but and then playing against Burr, let's see who else was back there. But I don't know. I just those two guys kind of early in my career. And then I was kind of intimidated. George Gervin was on the team, and I thought, oh, what kind of guy is he going to be like? I don't know. And Artis Gilmore.
Yeah.
And it turns out those guys were the nicest guys, kindest guys. They were great teammates. Just feel really lucky to have played with those two. Gervin was just, what's up, guys? What's going on today?
That's an amazing impression, by the way.
There was one time we were on the bus, and we had Johnny Moore, we had Gene Banks, we had couple Edgar Jones, a couple other college guys who had good college careers, and we were going to Philly to play Philly. So from the hotel to the arena, the entire way these guys were talking about how awesome they were in college. I did this, I did that. Oh, I was killing. I remember that game I killed in. Remember we played BYU and old Terrell Brandon just tore him up and all this stuff. And we pull into the parking lot. Gervin had not said a word. He's just sitting back there. We pull into the where we parked, and he stands up, starts walking down the aisle of the bus. Well, I didn't do much in college, but I got me a couple of NBA scoring titles. He walked off the bus.
That's amazing.
That was pre-mic drop, but it was if there was ever a mic drop, that was it. We all just sat there I guess we won't talk about things anymore.
That's amazing. I'm glad you dropped Edgar Jones because we're from Reno, Nevada. So Edgar Jones is a big deal for the Nevada Wolfpack. He's a legend. So that's awesome.
Edgar Jones was another he was a great teammate. I loved playing with Edgar.
Yeah.
He was a good friend.
Yeah, we've been itching to get Edgar on the show. There's so many – every guest we talk to has nothing but great things to say about Edgar. So, yeah.
But everybody but Alan Taylor, who's – I think it's – let me see. It was one of those Danny Ainge, Tree Rollin things. But I think that Edgar Jones. No, maybe it was Allen elbowed Edgar and knocked his tooth out. I think Edgar's tooth got stuck in Allen's elbow.
Oh, something like that. Oh, wow. A lot of elbows going around this podcast from what I've heard. So
yeah, well, you throw Kite and Alan Taylor in there, you're going to get some elbows.
Yep, and Devin. I mean, the list goes on. But
Devin, what a dirty player, I tell you.
you got to play some really special players. And, I mean, your next stop is Utah. And, I mean, you got to play the rookie Stockton and a rookie Malone. I'm just curious what your first impression was of those two and how you liked playing back home. That must have been pretty special.
Well, I was excited to get back to Utah, and that first year there, I played 2 years. The first year, it was kind of a special team. The year before, they surprised everybody, and I can't remember if they won the division, or I think they did win their division, and it was a big surprise because the Jazz had never been strong, but they had Stockton was a rookie. But he didn't play a lot. He was backup to Ricky Green. But they had AD who could score at will, basically. Yeah. Mark Eaton was starting to figure out how to block shots. Thurl Bailey was on the all-rookie team. And I came in there, and it was a good team as far as fit-wise. They guys liked each other. They support each other. Everybody kind of understood their role. We had guys like Billy Paltz and Rich Kelly. These big giant 7-footers who just go out there and knock people around, and they had enough experience in the league. They, the young guys, they kind of showed us the way. These veteran guys, and Adrian Dantley for sure. Daryl Griffith was having great years. Ricky Green, Stockton. I don't know if people remember this, but the first 3 years, Stockton was basically a backup and didn't play it. I mean, he played a good amount of minutes for a backup, but it wasn't until I had left there that's when he just took off. But and I didn't like him very much, Stockton, because it was my second year in the league, and I came into Utah. He was a rookie, and, you know, we kind of had this thing about rookies that, you know, you got your place. And right. Well, they put me in that place. I got to be rookie again.
Oh, no.
And Stockton got all the benefits. And because he was their first round draft pick. And I think I was just a Utah kid.
Yeah.
So I didn't really care for him a lot. We didn't get along. We got along, but I just thought, what the heck? How come this guy's getting all this? He doesn't have to carry the film projector. He doesn't have to carry the all this stuff. Why am I carrying it?
Yeah.
And he got all the good rooms. But then that summer, he and I, we went on some we went throughout some small towns in Utah, and we just did some basketball camps. And I just had the best time. It was so much fun going to these little smaller towns. We went to Price, we went to Ephraim, we went to Duchesne, different small towns around Utah, and even up into Wyoming. And we were vanning. They would take us to this place, and we'd have a hotel, and then we'd go someplace else the next night. And the next night, it was like we're in a rock group or something. But it was so much fun to be with Stockton and find out what a great guy he was and how hard he worked. I mean, I watched, and that was when Boston, they won the championship. They beat Houston in the championship. And after we do our basketball camp, we'd go back to the hotel and we'd put the, NBA championships. Yeah. Okay. We put the NBA championship games on Houston, Boston. And I sat there and I go, John, I just want so badly to be in a championship. I just want it so badly. And he kind of just sat there and didn't say anything. And I looked at him and he just had this look about him and said, well, you can want it all you want. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And I just had that sound, wow, this kid. And then some of the drills that he did, we did the camp, we'd work out together, and he showed me some drills that he does that were pretty helpful to me in my career. But just the great summer. And then they draft this kid. I had a great first year with Utah. We went on and we beat Houston in the first round in the playoffs. Oh, so I guess it wasn't. So it wasn't Houston playing Boston then. Anyway, that first year with Utah, I had a great playoffs. I had a pretty good season with them. That was the year that Billy Powell got punched by Hakeem, which was a great story. Just, the only guy in the entire arena who saw it was Thurl Bailey. Not one referee saw it, not one coach, not one player, just Billy Paltz, Hakeem, and Thurl Bailey. And but they kind of, Billy, after Hakeem punched him, Billy just got in Hakeem's head big time and it just took him out of the game. And so we win that, and then we go on and play. So I was feeling really good. I guess what I'm trying to say is I just had a really good year. I was feeling good. I said, okay, now I'm established. I got me a team. They draft this Karl Malone kid, and nobody knows anything about him. He's from 15th, you know, he's from Louisiana State. He's not even from the LSU. He's from Louisiana State. Who is this kid, you know? And I thought I had it. Karl Malone, he came into town, and we went up to the University of Utah to work out just as a pickup game, bunch of guys. And he just beat the shit out of everybody. I'm telling you, there was total mayhem. I looked out on the court and there were bodies laying all over. Malone just walking off. I'm here. Yeah. And I'm the new guy. I am the guy. That's and, awesome. Man, that's the way it was with him. The rest of the, he just came in and he knew he was going to just – he was going to be the guy. And you better either get out of the way or get on his shoulders.
Yeah, and most people did get out of the way. I remember you used to – stick the leg out on the dunks and the layups, you know, and it's funny that you kind of had a different impression of both of them. Stockton, you kind of didn't see happen until later, but Malone, it sounds like you knew right away. That's really cool. I love hearing those stories, man. And, you know, it's kind of funny that you're watching that Celtics game with Stockton because you ended up playing with the Celtics on that amazing team coming fresh off a championship. And what was it like going to training camp with a team coming fresh off a championship and how the intensity kind of picks up in that situation? And also, like, what was just the experience of experiencing an intense Lakers-Celtics finals? Like, not everybody gets to experience that. So what can you share about that?
Yeah. Well, that was – when I got traded again, I got it. So Utah, kind of things didn't work out that second year because Malone comes in was that all of a sudden he was going to be the guy and he took over. And so they were going to play him. And that I still thought, oh, that's all right. I'm going to be a role player. I'm okay with that. But I went from having pretty good minutes to 0 minutes. And so it wasn't a good thing for me that second year. I thought, oh, man, what am I going to do now? And I was one of those restricted free agents. And I was invited back to a camp that Boston had where they invited some college players and then some free agent guys, a restricted restricted free agent. And they had us play in this camp, and I had a really good camp, thankfully. So went back, but they made an offer. But, of course, Utah could match the offer. So they did. Utah matched the offer because they weren't going to give a guy away for nothing if they could get something. And back then, Utah, they were trying to get whatever they could. They weren't flush with a lot of money.
Right.
So they were trying to get something. And what they got for me were two exhibition games. So I've been traded for a coach, and I've been traded for two exhibition games.
I've
and
never heard of that ever.
Right, and so that was the deal. Which was a pretty good deal for Utah because if you get an exhibition game with Boston, they come out to Utah. That's going to be a sellout,
right?
And we did, And to get before I, I'll never forget Kevin McHale when we had to go out and play in that exhibition game. He says, "What? We got to go in Utah to play in preseason? Are you kidding me? Why do we have to go all the way out there? This is crazy. It was the stupidest thing." And we actually played at the Marriott Center at BYU. And Bird, the guy, he actually had two tip dunks because that Marriott Center floor is such a great floor that Bird even liked it. And he could jump and tip dunk. But, yeah that wasn't when they found out that I was the reason we had to go out and play, I took some harassing. But going up there, I was so intimidated and nervous about being in that locker room the first day. It's like jumping in a pool when you know it's cold, or you're going to have to jump off the high dive and you're scared to death, but there's only one way down and you have to just do it. And that's kind of the way I felt.
Yeah, but you had your friends in the water. You had Greg Kite and Danny Ainge in the water. So I'm surprised that you felt that way.
Yeah, well, even with those guys, it was, thank goodness, it was helpful to have them there for sure. They'd added some comfort. But, you know, I was intimidated by Bird. I was intimidated by McHale. Robert Parrish, I didn't know what to think of him. Scared to death of him. You know, have you ever seen that guy even smile? And I'm in the locker room getting dressed, and all of a sudden, in walks Robert Parrish. "What's up, freaks? What's going on?" And I thought, oh, okay. Not bad. All right. He's going to be all right. And we went out there. Of course, once you get into things and you run around, you start hitting each other, you loosen up, and it became a really good experience. And I think Boston, my playing there for 2 years was, of all things, was the one thing that extended my career, that made it so people noticed me and were more interested. Because back then, again, Boston and LA were really the only two teams playing on TV.
Right.
And we played in the championship, and I played, you know, every day in practice against Bird. And so they just, so coaches, teams, they saw that and they said, well, you know, this guy, you know, we bring him on our team. They think it's an advantage, and it probably was.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know where we are there, but it was a great experience playing in Boston for my career, for sure. Living there was difficult. I wasn't making enough money where I could afford to get into anything. And in Boston, it's so much more expensive than it was in Utah. But playing against Bird every day and learning from him, and just not even just playing against him, but watching him in games where he was just a warrior.
Oh, yeah.
The more guys beat him up, the more he responded, and the more he seemed to love it. He said, yes, give me more of this. Give me more of this, because I'll show you what I have. And he just come in after those Detroit games and scratched up, tore up. And, you know, they had five guys they throw at him.
Right.
Mahorn, they throw Rodman, Sally. Who was the other one? But anyway, those guys, they just beat him up every chance they got. They'd hold him and grab him because that's 20 fouls they could, or what? Sorry, that's probably not even right. It's 24 fouls, I guess, that they could afford to give up on Bird. They just beat him, but he seemed to love it.
Yeah, and they used those fouls, too. They used all of them. They weren't afraid
to use
them.
They sure did.
But
I think they're still fouling people.
Yeah, there's no question about that. But you got to have a favorite Larry Bird trash talk story, because, I mean, you just mentioned how much of a warrior he is. Like, there's got to be one trash talk story that comes to mind that just makes you chuckle just out of the blue. Like, what's that one story that comes to mind?
Well, there's a couple. I sometimes I like to keep them in my pocket because I want to be the only one that knows. But this guy loved that part of the game. He just loved, kind of just he had fun calling out people.
Yeah.
One time we were, Rick Carlisle and I, we would play one-on-one before every practice, it seemed like. And one day we're out there practicing, working on our game, playing one-on-one, and Larry was over in the, just come out of the locker room, standing over in the corner, he's watching us. He said, after we played a little bit, he said, "You guys are terrible." What are you talking about? He says, "You're terrible." He says, "Man, I think I could beat you both, one on two." And we said, "No, you can't." "Yeah, I think I can beat you." And he says, "And in fact, I'll bet you $5 I can beat you." So, all right, let's go. And he says, "And you know what else? I'm not going to dribble the ball." He says, I can beat you without dribbling the ball. And I can beat you without really moving." And he goes, "Oh, come on." And so he says, "But I get the ball first." And he says, "All right." So we play him. We give him the ball first. And so two against one kind of looks silly. So Rick and I were kind of guarding him, but kind of not, because we were embarrassed why we'd even take on something like this. And of course he makes the first basket.
Yeah.
And we're just going to five baskets. And then we said, "All right, okay, good shot." And then he makes the second basket. And I looked at Rick. I said, "Rick, we're both going to get cut today if we get beat."
Yeah.
And he says, so we got him, and we just knew it. Says, "If we don't get a hand on the ball, it's going in." Because we were up into him and everything. But if we knew, we thought, if we don't get a block, he's going to make another basket.
Yeah.
So we get a piece of the ball. We stop him. We beat that bugger. We stomped on his head. We beat him 5-3. And he still hasn't paid me the $5. And I'm mad about it.
Well, we'll try to get that $5 back for you. That's an amazing story, though. I mean,
yeah, if you put this out there so he knows. I can't believe he can still can sleep at night or whatever.
Yeah, we'll
but
try.
I will tell you this one, too. This was a great one. We're sitting there. I don't know. Does Devin talk as much as this?
Oh, Devin was great. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, we love it. The more talking, the better. We love these stories.
So we're sitting, we're playing in the Milwaukee series. We're playing in the playoffs. And it was just a mean, rough series. They had a bunch of rough guys. We were trying to be tough. And we're in Milwaukee in the Mecca. And Larry and I are sitting next to each other getting dressed for the game. And he looks at me and he says, "Well, Fred, so what do you think about when you go into a big game like this? What kind of things you're thinking about?" I said, "Hey, cool. Larry's asking me." I was still so impressed with him, you know, like a little kid. "Oh, Larry's talking to me."
Yeah.
But he says, I said, "Well, I want to think of our game plan. I want to think about the guy who I'm defending, what his strengths are, what his weaknesses are, and how I want to shade him. And how they're going to have to guard us." And he says, "Well, that's good. I'm glad you're thinking about that." So I thought, "Well, what the heck? Larry, what do you think about before the game, before a big game?" And he says, "I think about how scared those guys over in the other locker room must be to have to play me tonight." And I says, and I thought, dang, you know what? I've been in that other locker room, and he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
We were scared to death to have to play against him.
It's just amazing the confidence that he had. You know, the stories that you hear, they're just never ending. I mean, the confidence is unbelievable. But, I mean, yeah. With the confidence, like, you built some confidence too, because finding your role, I feel, is something that a lot of kids struggle with. I coach basketball, and I feel like they kind of struggle with finding a role. But also young professionals coming up, I feel, struggle with it. So, I mean, you found your role in Milwaukee. I feel like you contributed everywhere you went. So what's your advice to young kids coming up about how to find your role, whether it's on, you know, a varsity team or in the NBA? Like, what were the things that you did to really try to make it? Because a lot of these pros fizzle out and they're talented, but you didn't. So what would your advice be?
Well, I think in the pros for sure, or anywhere, being prepared you know, there were some games I'd play 5 minutes, 10 minutes, some games I didn't play. But I always knew that there was going to be an opportunity. There's somebody going to be in foul trouble. There's somebody going to be injured. And I knew that. I said, I've got to be ready for that moment. That moment, I've got to be ready if I want to establish myself. And so I did prepare for that, and I think that saved me. I think one of the greatest challenges right now, when I was in high school, we played 30 games. That was the number of games I played through the year. And my younger brother is 12 years younger than me. When he was in high school, he played over 100 games. And so now kids are playing so many games that the game kind of doesn't, it's kind of a catch 22. The games just, they don't do enough, I think, training on their own where they can develop some creativity, get outside their role on the team. And then also I think what parents do and coaches do is that game is the most important game in the world. We've got to win this game. And they forget about the development because the game you played 2 weeks ago, you have no memory of it.
Right.
And yet when you're playing right now, that's the most important game. We got to win this game. And they put away, they forget about the long-term development of young players, young kids. And I think as a young player too, if you have a bad game, you kind of beat yourself up and it's terrible. It's horrible. Instead of stepping back and say, you know what, in a week, I'm not even going to remember this game. I just need to think, okay, what can I learn? What can I learn about what I did? Is it just because it was an odd game, a weird game, a bad matchup for me? Was it because my body didn't feel right? I wasn't rested. And just know that it's a long race.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really good advice too, you know, for the young guys, because I feel like they don't really see the finish line a lot of times you know,
the finish line is right now.
Right.
Instead of, and that's, I don't mean to say that it isn't important. You've got to do your best. And as parents, we're sitting there, we got to win every game. And we're just so into the game. And then we get in the car with our kids. We think, and everybody's kind of a little intense and emotional, where I wish we could just say, as parents, I'm going to step back. I just want to watch and enjoy it. I just want to, the coach, it's his job to pay attention. And if we go in the car and it's like I told my wife one time, and I said, she was coaching me in the car. Wives are great, aren't they?
Oh yeah, no, I have one. She's great too. She does. She coaches me for sure. That's for dang sure.
Yeah, they coach you in the car, and I'm driving home. I go, what is going on here? I says, I just got cursed out by my coach, and now I'm in the car with my wife. And I said, sweetheart, I've got a coach. I said, can you just be my wife right now? I think that's what we need to know as parents. We say, you know, let's just be a parent right now. There are better lessons and more important lessons that we learn if we take our emotions out of it.
Yeah.
We can't really teach the kids much about the game if we're emotional. If we take the emotion out of it, then we can be helpful. And the kid's comfortable and the kid's not like stressed out about every moment out on the court.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I love that. And, you know, wives are great. They have a completely different perspective on things sometimes, but you're into teaching. I mean, speaking of teaching, you got into teaching, and I'm just curious if you knew that that's what you always wanted to do after your playing days, or did you have a vision of what you wanted to do with life after basketball? Because a lot of players don't really know right away.
So it was tough. It was a real struggle for me. I didn't think it would be, didn't know it would be. All I knew I wanted to do was play ball. You know, whatever ball it was, that's where I wanted to be. And then when I finished at 37 years old, I thought the whole world felt the same way, that Oh, I had Fred Roberts. He played ball, and I thought they paid attention to every road trip, every, you know, look at the stats each day in the paper. And when I got done, when I was finished, I thought, oh, I think I'm the only one who was checking that out, me and the other guys on the airplane. But, and so that was a challenge, and I didn't know what to do. I think I should have known, because I was curious about education. I had an idea once that, you know, I think it'd be cool to have a magazine with just a bunch of educational ideas and articles about that. But I never connected that I would actually go into teaching. And I fell into it. We put our kids into a school. Well, we wanted to get our kids into a school, and they said, we don't have any places for them, but we need a seventh grade teacher. If you teach, then we'll let your kids in. Yeah. Okay. I'll do that. And oh boy, what a challenge that was. The first day I stood up in front of kids, I felt my fingertips start to tingle. And then it went up my fingers, my hands, all the way up into my arms, my shoulders. I was just totally numb from the shoulders down. And I thought, I'm going to have a heart attack here. It was just terrible. Yeah. And I don't think I was very effective. And but I just kind of got into the educational scene. It was a good fit for me. It's worked out. And I'm glad I've done it. Yeah. I'm glad I'm back into it. I took 2 years off. Now I'm back in, and I'm glad I'm back in. I like it. I like being involved with kids, with education. And there's so many challenges, right? So in everything there is, but education, the challenges are really great. These kids, after having 2 years of COVID and having that mess up 2 years of their lives, I feel for them. I think it's a great challenge for them to try to get their lives back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, teaching's so rewarding. Like, I coach high school basketball, so I totally understand with the COVID thing and getting their lives back, because we didn't get a season 2 seasons ago. They had to sit the whole season out. They had to do everything online. And it was a challenging year for everyone. So it's great to see things slowly getting back to normal and seeing them get their lives back and getting kids back in the gym. I think it's really special. And you never flirted with coaching, you know, with all this teaching, you never flirted with coaching at all?
Well, this school where I am, I've coached here since I've been here. Okay. I've applied for high school jobs here in Utah. And, you know, for various reasons, I guess, I don't know. It's interesting, I always got an interview, but I learned in the interviews that most of the time they just wanted to hear stories like
right now.
Do.
Yeah.
Like right now. And, and it just didn't, I didn't get any interest. I did as help assistant coach, I think for 2 years at Lone Peak. And I thought, and then my son was going to be a senior, and I thought that I didn't think it was a good fit. I never did like coaches and their sons.
Yeah.
And so I stepped aside, and then I've had this opportunity here at this school, just a little charter school, but we've had a pretty good athletic program. The kids have been great, and I've enjoyed coaching here quite a bit.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Coach to coach, I appreciate what you do. And, you know, before we let you go, I'm going to do a quick lightning round with you. It's just a quick one or two word answer or quick sentence, if you don't mind. I got about 5 or 6 questions if you're ready for them.
Yeah, if I can. I had a high school coach. We'd sometimes be in the locker room after game till midnight because he just couldn't stop talking. I thought, this is horrible, terrible. And then I turned into him.
Hey, and that's fine. Anything goes on this podcast. So however long you want to take is totally fine with me. But my first question to you is, who's your toughest cover as a player, the one guy you just couldn't figure out how to guard?
I had a hard time. Well, James Worthy was tough. He was really hard to guard. And then a guy like Kiki Vandeweghe was a bear to guard when he was going. He could shoot and he could drive. He could handle, he could dunk the ball either hand. So I think those two guys, you know, Bird was always a beast. Dominic Wilkins, when he got hot, oh my gosh.
Oh yeah.
He shot one from, sorry, I'm breaking the rule, but he shot a three-pointer. I went up to get a hand up on the three-pointer from the left corner. When I came down, I turned and looked to see if the shot went in, and he was tip dunking it, flying across the middle, tip dunking his three-point shot.
That's amazing.
I couldn't, I just thought, what the heck? So he was a bugger.
That's incredible. Yeah, and I love that you dropped a Kiki Vanderway. We do not hear that name enough. That was, he was a phenomenal player. I'm really, that really makes me happy you dropped his name. One of my favorites.
Well, when a guy scores 50 on you, you remember.
Well, I won't make you tell that story. I won't make you tell that one. But, did you ever have a nickname that stuck?
A little bit in college. They called me Boo. I came into it from high school. We are a bunch, you know how high school is, you're a bunch of goofballs, and everybody was Boo. Hey Boo, what's going on, Boo? How you doing, Boo? Yeah. And I was the big Boomin. And I said, Boomin, what's going on, Boomin? And then when we went to college, they kept it up and called me Boo. I wasn't crazy about it.
That's awesome. Any weird superstitions that you or a teammate had that come to mind?
Not weird. I used to pray that the bus would get in an accident on the way to the game sometimes. We're playing Bird tonight. Can we just get in a car accident? Oh, Michael Jordan. Let's just get in a crash. I would prefer a crash over playing Michael Jordan.
That's amazing.
Okay, I should have mentioned him.
Yeah. I think it's the first podcast that no one's mentioned Michael Jordan, which is great. That's totally great. So
yeah.
Who's one guy that you wish you could have played with though?
Played with?
Yeah.
I wish I could have played with my era. I would have loved to play on the Milwaukee team with Lou Alcindor and Oscar Robertson.
Ooh, tough.
I think those guys, when Lou Alcindor was Lou Alcindor, not Abdul-Jabbar, but I think I would have loved to play with those guys.
Absolutely. And that's one of my favorite eras to learn about. We had Tom Van Arsdale on, and it's an amazing era. But you got to play with both Larry and Magic. You're one of the few guys that got to play with both Larry and Magic. Who's the better teammate? Or who's the most fun to play with, I should say?
Well, Magic, it was a weird year because that was the year he was trying to make a comeback in the league. And so he'd play with us in practice and work out with us all the time, but it wasn't until the very end. It was more of a distraction because, is Magic coming back? Is he going to come back? Well, this team's not going to be any good unless Magic comes back. And so that was a little bit of a distraction. But playing with him and knowing that he knew that the important thing for basketball is, like, he and Bird both had the same ideas about being successful. They knew that they had to be successful on the court to make everything else happen off the court. But a lot of guys, the off the court stuff becomes more important than on the court.
Right.
They always knew they had to take care of that first, take care of on the court and give everything you have there. And then the rest of it takes care of itself.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to play with Magic in his glory years where he was great. I would have been, well, it's like playing with Stockton, where all you had to do is, if you get your hands up, you knew the ball was going to hit you in the hands. You just had to be ready. You get them up. And Magic was the same way. Stockton was so great that way. I mean, just really, if you moved, and you kept your hands up, you were going to receive the ball in your hands.
Yeah.
And then Bird, he was so great because of his tenacity, his toughness, and he could be funny. But the 2 years I was there, he was pretty serious, and I think he was more of a private person. And those are the 2 years after he won the MVP, where they won the championship. There's so much attention going to him. I think he was getting to the point where he was getting a little tired of it. So right. He was not having as much fun as I think. When I was traded, I came back and he kind of let all that stuff go. He seemed like he was having a lot more fun.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And they're so different. You know, that's why I wanted to ask that. And you're right. There's a lot of distractions going on the Magic year. Like, I mean, I'm young. I was young, but I definitely remember the whole comeback and just how much uncertainty there was with the HIV thing. And, you know, I could definitely see that being a little bit of a distraction. But I got one last question for you. And it's a loaded one, but I ask everybody this. But what's your favorite basketball memory if you had to pick just one?
My favorite basketball memory is winning a world title. I was on two teams, a junior world team, and we played for the world championship in Brazil. That was a team. Oh my gosh, we had a good team down there. James Worthy, Lafayette Lever, Sleepy Floyd. Oh man, I'd go down a list of who else we had on that team, but that was a good team. And then we won a world championship in Romania. And the feeling that you get when you're in another country and you're standing on the podium with a gold medal and they're playing your national anthem, I think that will forever be my favorite time. Maybe not favorite time, but what a favorite memory. I mean, there's games I played where I just had great games, but to feel the feeling that it is to stand on a podium in a foreign country playing your national anthem was incredible.
That is incredible. And if you don't mind, I actually thought of one last question that I always get some crazy answers out of, but you played overseas for a few years and you just mentioned, you know, the championship and everything, but what's the craziest thing that you've ever experienced playing overseas? Because I've heard a lot of things, whether it's in the game, with the fans, you know, people throwing coins or like bombs going off. Like, what's that one memory that just is the wildest?
Oh, man. There's nothing like playing in Europe for sure. The time we played in Istanbul, I was with Barcelona and we were playing the European Cup. And so we had to go play in Istanbul against Turkey. And I didn't realize at the time the difference between the European side of Turkey and the Asian side of Turkey. So we're over there in Europe, in the Europe side, where we're in the hotel and it's pretty normal. And then we get on the bus and we went across the bridge to the Asian side to where the arena was. And as we're driving out to the arena, it's pretty rural, but all along the way, and this had to be 15, 20 minutes, we're driving the road, and all along the road, there are cars with people screaming at us, yelling and honking and booing. We get to the arena, and let's just get inside, let's get out of this mess, and because outside it was crazy, people screaming at us, yelling at us. Let's just get inside where we can be safe.
Yeah.
We went in there. I got dressed, went out to do some early shoot around, and the arena was completely packed. and it was all men.
Yeah.
And they were all smoking, and they were just screaming and singing and hollering. And okay, I'm out. I'm going back in the locker room.
Yeah.
When we came back out to play, to do our regular warm-ups, we chose our basket. Visiting team always gets to choose its basket. And we're doing our layups. Well, here comes the Turkish team. And they wanted the same basket. Well, the visiting team gets to choose, right? Well, they start doing layups with us. So we've got both teams doing layups on the same basket. And all this smoke-filled arena. And people are whistling and screaming. And the referees are standing at half court. We said, hey, do something. Nope, we're not doing anything. So that was probably my wildest memory over there. I've heard some other stuff that's pretty crazy, but that was something I experienced that was wild.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things to learn about. There's nothing like the overseas stories. So I appreciate you sticking around extra to share that one. But Fred, I really enjoyed today's conversation, man. This was such an honor. My dad is a huge fan, and he showed me a lot of old games. And I grew up, you know, watching you a lot, and I've heard a lot of great stories, and you know, from Devin, Greg, all those guys. So this is truly an honor, man. So I really appreciate you being on today.
Well, you're welcome. And when you cut us off, I've got a name for you that you would have a ton of fun interviewing.
Oh, we'd love that. Well, I'm going to go ahead and hit stop right now. So, I appreciate it. Fun episode as always. Shout out Fred Roberts. Thanks again for coming on. That was truly an honor. We've had quite a few BYU players on lately, and we have such a huge BYU following on this podcast. I know they love this one just as much as I did. So thank you, Fred Roberts, for taking the time. I know our listeners are going to really enjoy this one. And speaking of listeners, thank you guys. You've helped us chart in 30 plus countries now, top five in quite a few of those. That's incredible that just this little podcast from Reno has been able to make some noise. And it's all because of you guys and the comments and the reviews that you leave us. And if you haven't left a comment or review on Apple yet, if you could, that'd mean the world to us. It really helps us get great guests like Fred. It just makes us feel good. So if you wouldn't mind, it takes a minute. It's free. We'd really appreciate that. But we got so much more incredible guests on the way, a lot more fun stuff in the works. We're really excited. Season 4 is going to be here before we know it. And boy, do we got some good ones coming up. So really excited for that. And it's all because of you guys and our wonderful guests that, you know, keep this thing building. So we just love and appreciate all of you. But I am out. Enjoy the rest of your week. Stay healthy. Stay safe. I'm out. Peace.